The streets are lonely. Worcester is the second largest city in New England, but to many, it's invisible. Maybe it's because of the pandemic. One could possibly blame inflation. A historian would say it was deindustrialization. No renaissance to see here. In a city with 205,272 residents, housed and unhoused, a population in decline, beware all ye who enter. We know where the road will lead us. Massachusetts has a radical tradition that goes as far back as the colonial era, when cousins Sam and John aided a costly revolution. This tradition carried on time and again, bringing forth the abolitionists of the pre-Civil War era. Less than a century later, political radicals took refuge at Cape Cod. Today, the width of radicals stretches far across the Commonwealth, with no chance of stopping. We stop at one such inspiration for a dissident who took to the woods. Henry David Thoreau was allowed a spot of land in 1845, while with Ralph Waldo Emerson, as a reprieve from the constraints of post-Harvard life. He hoped to write a book, as well as live by his own transcendental principles, a revolt against the six-day work week. The book was so named after the pond, Walden, and the adjacent land became his home for 2 years. It yielded some success, the book, but he also found himself spending a night in a jail cell. This inspired his essay, once required reading, but probably now banned across the South for some unreason, Civil Disobedience. Does not America offer any inducement for men to settle here? The American has dwindled into an odd fellow, one who may be known by the development of his organ of gregariousness, and a manifest lack of intellect and cheerful self-reliance, whose first and chief concern on coming into the world is to see that the almshouses are in good repair, and, before yet he has lawfully donned the virile garb, to collect a fund for the support of the widows and orphans that may be, who, in short, ventures to live only by the aid of the mutual insurance company, which has promised to bury him decently. It is there that the fugitive slave and the Mexican prisoner on parole and the Indian come to plead the wrongs of his race should find them, on that separate but more free and honorable ground where the state places those who are not with her but against her. The only house in a slave state in which a free man can abide with honor. If any think that their influence would be lost there, and their voices no longer afflict the ear of the state, that they would not be as an enemy within its walls, they do not know by how much truth is stronger than error, nor how much more eloquently and effectively he can combat injustice, who has experienced a little in his own person. Cast your whole vote, not a strip of paper merely, but your whole influence. A minority is powerless while it conforms to the majority. It is not even a minority then, but it is irresistible when it clogs by its whole weight. If the alternative is to keep all just men in prison, or give up war and slavery, the state will not hesitate which to choose. If 1,000 men were not to pay their tax bills this year, that would not be a violent and bloody measure, as it would be to pay them, and enable the state to commit violence and shed innocent blood. This is, in fact, the definition of a peaceable revolution, if any such is possible. If the tax gatherer or any other public officer asks me, as one has done, but what shall I do? My answer is, if you really wish to do anything, resign your office. Is a democracy such as we know it the last improvement possible in government? Is it not possible to take a step further towards recognizing and organizing the rights of man? There will never be a really free and enlightened state until the state comes to recognize the individual as a higher and independent power, from which all its own power and authority are derived, and treats him accordingly. I please myself with imagining a state at last which can afford to be just to all men, and to treat the individual with respect as a neighbor. Which even would not think it inconsistent with its own repose, if a few were to live aloof from it, not meddling with it, nor embraced by it, who fulfilled all the duties of neighbors and fellow men. A state which bore this kind of fruit, and suffered it to drop off as fast as it ripened, would prepare the way for a still more perfect and glorious state, which also I have imagined, but not yet anywhere seen. Thoreau died of tuberculosis in 1862, in the midst of war and on the verge of America's unfinished revolution, Reconstruction. Emerson said at his funeral, "The country knows not yet, or in the least part, how great a son it has lost. His soul was made for the noblest society. He had in a short life exhausted the capabilities of his world. Wherever there is knowledge, wherever there is virtue, wherever there is beauty, he will find a home." You probably remember Don Henley from Dirty Laundry. What a song to eulogize my industry. Before the 14-year vacation ended, he founded the Walden Woods Project as a means to preserve Walden Pond and the surrounding woods. My parents, my love, and I walked these woods in October. Such a fine sight to see. A state like Massachusetts has an abundance of natural areas to hike, bike, camp, and dream in. But Walden's significance in history cements its need to survive the 21st century. What is the use of a house if you haven't got a tolerable planet to put it on? News guy wept and told us Earth was really dying. Cried so much his face was wet. Then I knew he was not lying. A kiss. Love me two times. The sights of Lexington and Concord are American mythology personified, the likes of which one cannot comprehend in California. My appeal to the Adamses aside, and with my back turned from the Enlightenment, walking the ground so memorialized, from history textbooks to AP quizzes to History Channel and Fox News programs, place an emphasis on this place comparable only to Megiddo. Whether it started with the Boston Massacre or the signing of the Declaration, this is where it all began. Perhaps not as comparable with Plymouth, Jamestown, and Hispaniola, but these grounds are as much of an origin story for these states united as they will ever have or get. We head for the car in an attempt to stop at Minuteman National Historic Park. But it's before 4 and already sunset. The threat of the park closing pushes us east as we near the home of one of America's most lauded hipsters.
Your ASMR queens.
And it's not Jack Antonoff. On the road was the novel suburbanites dream to live. I was one of those suburbanites, but my journey across America did not resemble that of Dean Moriarty or Sal Paradise. Jack Kerouac's seminal 1957 work came when the consensus broke, never to return. A new politics was in order, but he was no prophet bringing with him commandments. He brought with him an eye to nature and the other eye to the bottle. We arrive at his birthplace in Lowell, where he grew up on 9 Lupine Road. It's been almost 10 years since I read On the Road, and I dread returning to it. Big Sur and Vanity of Deleuze put me to sleep. He may have understood NorCal, but he couldn't write it. My bias knows no bounds, though my heart is in the Southland, always. Charles Bukowski criticized writing with no life, no sunlight. Each line must be full of delicious little juice, flavor. They must be full of power. They must make you like to turn a page. Writing must never be boring. It must not bore the reader, the writer. It must not bore anybody. Each line must be an entity unto itself, must carry its own, like a voltage, juice. Another half-hour journey brings us to Lawrence, the battleground of one of the most daunting moments in American history, and hardly anyone knows about it. The Bread and Roses Strike of 1912 brought together Scotch, Syrian, German, Italian, French, Polish, Russian, and so many more migrants from across the world into this sleepy textile mill producing town into a last stand of solidarity. Workers organized across ethnic and gender lines and walked off the job as they saw their pay depleted. Hundreds stood firm while food was served to freezing children. Most of that with great thanks to their mothers, who took to the streets. Some strikers died, as documented in Bruce Watson's tragic yet mesmerizing tale of the strike. But the workers won when a 20% raise was settled. Eugene Debs praised the strikers, calling their victory while on the campaign trail one of the most decisive and far-reaching ones ever won by organized workers. Perhaps it is forgotten because of the Red Scare. The IWW, Debs, Emma Goldman, and so many with only a minor association, or even a major association with the strike, were cast aside, as history books cast aside this daring crossroads of a moment. Thanks to a gubernatorial candidate from the state of my birth, Upton Sinclair, the association with the textile strike and a fragment of a poem stuck together. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. Where the mills once stood, now stand a shoe factory and nearby apartments. Apartments that'll likely cost a pretty penny to anyone, middle or working class, who's looking for a home. Is this a betrayal of those who fought so hard over 100 years ago? You decide. Back to the present.
Bankrupt.
We arrive in Somerville, just outside of Boston, strolling the sidewalks of a shopping center. It's the Camarillo Outlets meets the Glendale Galleria, Assembly Row. From Clark's to lingerie to Legos to barbecue, Christmas time is in full bloom on this weekend after Thanksgiving. All of it is so familiar, as is my life now. Why wouldn't it be?
I mean, not 90.
What a long year it's been. Am I the same man I was on my last travelogue? At that time, I had a sense my days in California were coming upon suspension, as they sure were. Have I become Camus' outsider? To call myself a stranger in a strange land would be cliché, but I take pride in feeling as much of a foreigner as any foreign national standing in awe before an American supermarket. These thoughts don't stop me in my tracks, nor do they paralyze me with a feeling of, what have I done? The life I've chosen has regrets, but there are none to be found here. My life and love are here, a twin set that differs from my life on the West Coast and my love for the city I was born in. But that's a life and love I carry with me every day, never shirking from where I came from, and never questioning the path I've laid before me. Going home now. Highway lights are blinding. Not the orange blur one is used to on the 405 or 5 freeways. A shadowy path with faded markers and supernovas whizzing by like comets. We arrive to Worcester in time for a good freeze, one of many that are expected to carry on for the next 5 to 6 months or so. My love beside me keeps me warm. Home is right around the corner. Probably heard the rub of my jacket. No, George, it's not Gore-Tex. The days and nights of love and war dropped down into the 30s during the day, maybe into the 20s at night. Good thing I don't need my heater when the sun turns my apartment into a fusion reactor.
Wait.
2024 is upon us, and I cannot think of a better way than to be here, as the gears of electioneering and dull rhetoric that are about to make up the conversation for the next year drive us further off the cliff. Buy the ticket, take the ride. I'm happy. Something I thought the days of plague had stripped from me. Yes, there's still grief. Grief when I read the headlines of thousands dead in yet another pointless war. I have been overwhelmed by it in recent weeks, but I stand firm in my principles and in thoughts shared by some of those I've brought up and quoted today. It's time to say no. It's time to stand tall. It's time to help friends and strangers. As LA's biographer said, listen carefully to the quietly profound people who have lost everything but their dignity. I read the news today, oh boy. Henry Kissinger has left this world as innocent as the next guy. Social media exploded at the news. What a frustrating, cruel world he created and left behind for us to survive in. No trial, but the verdict is clear. By now you have probably seen Anthony Bourdain's quote about him. No bad writing to see here. Many of Kissinger's enemies, innocent or armed with the pen, did not get to live to see this day. It's a reminder of our mortality, and a reminder on who writes history. That's why I chose this life. History and the mass movements of people have been my life's work and passion. As far as I know, it will go on. Don't think that it'll leave me yet. Mars on Life is a podcast co-hosted by Sebastian Shug, Ryan Mancini, Andrew Martinez, and Matt Fernandez. If you like this episode, rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe wherever you listen to your favorite shows, as Mars on Life is available on Anchor, Radio Public, iHeartRadio, Audible, Spotify, and Podchaser. Find us on Instagram at Mars on Life Show to keep up with the latest news, episodes, and gratuitous updates on the Red Planet. Have a question, comment, or request? Email us at marsonlife@gmail.com. and will promptly get back to you. This show's artwork, titled Happy Mars, was drawn by Zachary Erbrick. Our show's regular intro and outro music is Space Explorers by the one and only Kevin MacLeod. Thank you for listening, and always remember, if you keep going, you'll make it to Mars.